Hello, welcome to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris. In this month's episode, we investigate how our partner preferences develop as we move from adolescence to adulthood. We also find out when a woman is most likely to sleep with a stranger, discover how to go about designing the perfect partner, and learn whether big breasts are more popular in New Zealand or New Guinea. This is the September and October edition of the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast from oraclelab.co.uk. As those who listen to the August episode will know, I recently moved back from the US to the UK, which is why this episode is a few weeks late. Sorry for the delay. Rather than skip the September episode, I've decided to talk today about some of the most interesting research from both September and October. Next time, we're going to be back to the normal one episode per month format. Also, I noticed recently that only about a quarter of the people who download this podcast are subscribed. If you want to make sure you get new episodes as soon as I release them, head over to oraclelab.co.uk, click on podcasts and follow the instructions. Or search for the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast on iTunes. That way, new episodes will be delivered automatically to your MP3 device. We often think of ourselves as having a type, an attraction to different people who share similar characteristics, whether that means bad boys or girls next door, or blondes or brunettes. And we often think of that type as something that's consistent and doesn't change over time. But even if these preferences are static once we're adults, they must have developed from somewhere because almost every child of a certain age has an instinctive revulsion for their peers of the opposite sex. So how do we come to find certain traits attractive? And at what point during our physical and mental development do these changes occur? Tamsin Saxton of the University of Edinburgh has done much of the best work in this area and has recently published a new paper on age, puberty, and the attractiveness judgments of adolescents. She created pairs of faces that were identical in all respects except for three properties: masculinity, symmetry, and averageness. Previous research has shown that symmetric and average faces are more attractive. By the way, when we talk of facial averageness, we don't necessarily mean someone who looks plain. We mean that the features and face shape of that person are close to the population mean, with an average-sized nose, average-sized ears, and eyes that are the average distance apart. Feminine-faced women and masculine-faced men are also attractive. All these traits are thought to be appealing because they're associated with physical health or genetic diversity, which are traits it makes sense to pass on to our offspring. Saxton also made voice pairs that differed in pitch, because previous research has shown that men prefer higher pitched voices and women prefer a lower pitch. Saxton presented the stimuli to 72 adolescents in the Czech Republic and found that, like adults, they preferred faces that were average and symmetric. Both male and female adolescents preferred faces that were feminine over faces that were masculine, and this could be because the masculine faces appeared more mature and were therefore less attractive to the adolescent girls, who preferred males whose age was similar to their own. There was no preference for a deeper or a higher voice, so clearly voice preferences emerged later on than face preferences. Another interesting finding was that when the adolescents were grouped according to their pubertal development stage, those who were further into puberty expressed a stronger preference for facial symmetry. This effect was irrespective of age, so it's unlikely to be the result of older children having seen more faces over their relatively longer lives. Instead, the ability to judge a person's attractiveness based on their facial symmetry seems to be a product of physical maturity. I've talked several times before on this podcast about the ovulatory preference shift hypothesis, which is the idea that what women seek in a partner changes over the course of their menstrual cycle. Around ovulation, about 2 weeks after menses begins, women tend to up their preferences for masculine traits, like a robust jawline, a muscular body, and an aggressive personality. The explanation for this so-called preference shift is that masculine men have good genes, and if a woman sleeps with these men when she's most fertile, she's more likely to become pregnant and have healthier offspring. Masculine men aren't preferred at other times because they tend to make worse long-term partners than feminine men, who are more prepared to invest time and resources in a relationship. Put simply, there may be two broad types of man, masculine and feminine, and women's evolved psychology allows them to target each type at the times when it makes most sense to do so. This implies that women may have historically fared better if they secured a long-term partner who was feminine and committed, and then sneakily slept with sexy masculine men on the side. If this is true, we should find that women's preferences for unfamiliar men become greater around ovulation. This question is addressed by a study by Steve Gangstad, Randy Thornhill, and Christine Garver-Apgar, scientists who've led the way in this field of research for more than a decade. They gave women a questionnaire to complete when they were in the fertile phase of their cycles around ovulation, and then again during the later part of the cycle, the luteal phase, when conception is less likely. The survey revealed that when women are fertile, they experience greater arousal at the thought of attractive men and express a stronger interest in having sex with those men. And this is true even if those men are strangers. It's often thought that only men are opportunistic when it comes to selecting short-term partners, but this research shows that women can be opportunistic too, but at times when it suits them most to be so. If you think about it, this makes sense because every time a heterosexual man has a short-term fling, a heterosexual woman is having a short-term fling at the same time. So a short-term strategy is obviously not a male preserve. Gangstad and colleagues have been especially busy these last few months because they also published a second paper on this topic, which appeared in the same recent issue of the journal Evolution and Human Behaviour. In that paper, the researchers found that when women are in the fertile phase of their cycle, they express stronger preferences for men who are not their primary partner, if their primary partner is feminine-faced. So, if a woman's partner looks like Gerard Butler, she may be less inclined to go hunting for a secret short-term partner when she becomes most fertile. If her primary partner is more feminine, like, say, Orlando Bloom, then she's more likely to look elsewhere once she hits ovulation. Again, this makes sense if we think of short-term relationships as women's way of securing good genes for their offspring. If women's partners already have these good genes, that is, if they're masculine, then there's less need for women to seek those qualities elsewhere. Now, does someone want to break the news to Orlando Bloom, or is that my job? What kind of characteristics do you look for in a partner? Do they need a good sense of humour? Does it matter if they're physically attractive? Do you value wealth, ambition, gregariousness, fidelity, honesty, good parenting skills, or intelligence? There are lots of things we might want in a partner, and it might be difficult to find all those things in one person. If we really want a rich partner, we might be willing to compromise on physical attractiveness, or vice versa. How we compromise depends on which traits we value most highly, and it might also depend on whether we have desirable traits of our own with which to bargain. One way to work out what people value most in a partner is to have them play a simple game. Ask them to design the perfect partner. That's what John Edlund of the Rochester Institute of Technology did in a recent study, which was published in the journal Personality and Individual Differences. He had 171 students assign a minimum and an ideal level of 22 characteristics they'd like to see in a mate. The traits were subdivided into categories such as family orientation, health, friendliness, and attractiveness. At first, there were no limits as to how high participants could set their minimum and ideal criteria. But then Edlund had them repeat the task three times, each time with a different sized budget. Participants had 20, 40, or 60 points to allocate amongst the different traits. To design a partner who was as physically attractive as the top 10% of the population, participants had to allocate 10 points to that trait, and the same for the remaining traits. So, even with a large budget, it wasn't possible to design a perfect partner in the top 10% for all traits. Finally, participants completed a questionnaire that tapped how attractive they thought themselves to be. Those who received a high score thought they were a catch, and those with a low score considered themselves to be nearer the bottom of the heap. The results showed that people who thought they were more attractive tended to specify higher minimum and ideal criteria, even in the unbudgeted task when they could theoretically have set their preferences as high as they wanted. There were some predictable differences between men and women. Men wanted partners who were more physically attractive, for example, while women valued yearly income more highly. When given a small budget, men allocated a greater proportion of their points to friendliness than when they had a larger budget, which implies that friendliness is a necessity for men rather than a luxury. There was also a moderately reliable effect of a person's own attractiveness on how many points they allocated to physical attractiveness in their ideal partner. Men who thought they were a catch spent more on physical appearance than did men who thought they were personally less attractive. This was especially true in the smaller budget conditions, which suggests attractiveness is a necessity for attractive men, but not for unattractive men, who are content to trade it off against other desirable traits. Similarly, women who thought they were more attractive tended to design a mate with a higher yearly income, presumably because they felt that their own mate value gave them greater buying power when it came to snagging a rich partner. To sum up, attractive people tend to want a partner who has attractive traits, but the type of traits a person values most depends on how attractive they are themselves. Finally this month, that old chestnut, do all men like big breasts? There are some who've suggested that men's preferences for breast shape and size are culturally specific, meaning that those from different cultures tend to have different preferences. Barnaby Dixon of the Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand tested this hypothesis by presenting men from Papua New Guinea, Samoa and New Zealand with images of women's breasts. It's a tough job, but someone's got to do it. Men from these three cultures were chosen because they differ in the extent to which they have access to modern healthcare and an abundant supply of food. One hypothesis is that men from poorer environments should prefer women who look healthier or who have more abundant fat reserves. That is, they should prefer women with symmetric and large breasts. Dixon found that men from the least developed society, Papua New Guinea, preferred larger breasts to a greater extent than men from the other two cultures, Samoa and New Zealand. This supports the hypothesis because bigger breasts indicate larger fat reserves and an ability to survive periods of poor nutrition, something men from New Guinea should be especially sensitive to. However, men from the different cultures didn't differ in their preferences for symmetric breasts. All men preferred symmetry, but there were no cultural differences. It was expected that men from New Guinea would prefer symmetry more than the other men because symmetric breasts are indicative of health, and in New Guinea there's reduced access to healthcare and a much greater incidence of pathogenic infections such as malaria. What this study demonstrates is that when we investigate attractiveness, it's worthwhile looking at different cultures because preferences can vary from group to group. I for one agree, and if anyone wants to send me to a tropical Pacific island to riffle through pictures of naked women, they can email me at podcast@oraclelab.co.uk. That's all for this episode. If you'd like to find out more about the research featured in today's show, head over to www.oraclelab.co.uk and click on podcasts. You can also keep up with new research throughout the month by following Oracle Lab on Twitter. Until next time, thanks for listening to the Psychology of Attractiveness podcast. I'm Rob Burris.